And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine, and on the internet at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is Robert Kanigal, author of High Season, How One French Riviera Town Has Seduced Travelers for 2,000 Years, published by Viking. He's also author of The One Best Way, Apprentice to Genius, and The Man Who Knew Infinity, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. His articles and essays have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Civilization, and Wilson Quarterly. Robert teaches writing at MIT and lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
Great to have you with us. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling better. I've been having some back problems, and I'm feeling better now.
No surgery?
Thank you. No, not surgery yet.
All right. We're not going to talk about your back.
No.
We'll talk about your book.
Big mistake. Yes, much better idea.
You know, you looking at the titles you've published, these books all seem to be so different. Are they so different, or do you find that there is a the root of them is somewhat the same?
Well, I think the root of any series of books lies in, you know, the personality and experience of the author. I think the first three books were all about driven men and women working at the limits of their what they could do. Geniuses in one sense, hard-driving people, work. And I think maybe I'd had enough of that. I hadn't realized that actually somebody who had interviewed me for a newspaper actually pointed it out. I missed it. He saw it. That High Season was a kind of antidote to the other books. The other books were in one sense about work, and this is about freedom from work. It's about leisure. It's about pleasure, and it's about the place of those in our lives and how we all need it.
Yeah. How did the specific idea come about?
Actually, it came about from the last book. The last book was a biography of the sufficiency expert who lived in the, Frederick Winslow Taylor, who lived at the late 19th century, early 20th century. And I got all of his teenage diaries. And I followed him around to where he had gone. He was a rich kid. And the thing I noticed was that wherever he went 100 years ago, this is about 1869, wherever he went with his wealthy family, where there were just a few people 100 years ago, were tourist meccas today. That there had been in the ensuing 100 and some odd years a kind of democratization of tourism. And that fascinated me, the fact that you or I or average Joes can pick up and leave our work and have something like the kind of pleasurable experiences that only rich people could 150 years ago. That's a kind of a social miracle.
Yes.
And in the largest sense, that's what this book is about, is it's how that social miracle has taken place and the what's good about it, and also the price paid for the fact that we can do that.
Interesting. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Robert Kanigal, author of High Season, How One French Riviera Town Has Seduced Travelers for 2,000 Years. It's interesting, the title is interesting to me because you never, of course you don't say in the title what the town is.
Mm-hmm.
Has this title always been with the book?
Pretty much. One of the most unusual aspects about it is that High Season has changed in the course of the Riviera's history. Briefly, the book is about Nice, France. Nice, France is the capital of the French Riviera, and was the first town to become a tourist enclave. But High Season is the height of the tourist season. High Season used to be winter, now, of course, it's summer. We just automatically think of bare bodies on the beach, browning under a beautiful sun, and that's our image. That's our notion of what a vacation, what a holiday is. And high season back 75 or 100 years ago was winter.
Interesting.
People in London or Paris wouldn't dream of going to a place like Nice in the summer. The idea was to escape the miserable northern winters where it was gray and dark and overcast and cloudy and stormy and miserable, and go to this place where, while it wasn't hot in the winter, obviously, it was much, much sunnier.
Interesting. I like what, I think it's Kirkus. Yes, it is Kirkus, what Kirkus said about the book and about you. In that last line, like an enthralled biologist, the author observes the evolution of Nice as a social ecosystem. His portrait is as spellbinding as its subject. You must like lines like that.
I do. we shouldn't be surprised that I like lines like that. But one of the things that I felt that review and some of the other reviewers got is that while this book is filled with the warm air and the sun of Nice in particular, it's also about all tourist locations everywhere. It's about how they got that way, that there is kind of an arc. I guess this is where that little scientific metaphor crept in there, that there is a progress to these towns where they start out as, you know, like little undiscovered fishing ports or little minor fortresses or all sorts of little out-of-the-way places, and they start getting discovered, and the inn people start going there, and then they build and build and build, and then at some point they begin to lose their sparkle to the people who can afford to go anywhere they want. Of course, the hoi polloi have descended on the place, and this is the tale that I tell of Nice. One of the things that makes Nice ideal for telling it is that it's gone through the whole arc. It's gone through the whole progress. It allows you to tell the whole fascinating story of tourism through this single place.
Yes. Something else is that this book, well, I could see other authors, lesser authors, taking this topic and, not quite giving it the breadth and depth that you have in terms of there's history, there's just a ton of stuff that that we find out about Nice and that we never imagined.
Yeah. I guess you asked earlier the common ground for all my books, and I think one of them, all my writing really, is how things get to be the way they are. How things that we so routinely take for granted have gotten that way. And you go to a place like Nice, or you go to a place like Nantucket in Massachusetts, or Annapolis in Maryland, or Salzburg in Austria, any one of these places that are huge tourist draws today, and it's almost impossible to imagine them being anything other than what they were.
Yes.
And the fact is they all started off much more humbly, in much, much different straits, in much different conditions. They had to become what they were going to become, and that was not preordained. That wasn't guaranteed. It wasn't like God from on high said, thou shalt be a tourist attraction. Things had to happen. And I think it's that quality of just what happened and how it happened and how it could not have happened that animates the telling of the story.
Mm.
And it is a story. In some ways, this is a biography of a town, as one of the reviewers pointed out. It's a biography of a specific kind of town and how it got that way.
Mm. How much research did you have to do for this?
I like research.
Yeah.
I like a lot is the answer, is the short answer. I like poring through archives and reading books on my subjects and going far afield from my subject in ways that often seem very distant from the center line of the subject, if you can imagine that, but that often bear upon it. So in this book, I found a lot of travel diaries and journals of people in the 19th century and 18th century who had traveled to Nice and the Riviera, both published and unpublished. Probably some of the biggest fun is encountering the unpublished stuff that has never been seen since the person originally wrote it sometimes and was just stuck in some archive and some cataloged it, and that's it. It's never been seen, and you encounter it. That's pretty exciting. So I enjoy that. But as I say, I also like coming in from sometimes strange angles. So, for example, there's a World War II section in this book about how the same hotels that were the sites of lovers' trysts and relaxation and recreation and sitting with a croissant and coffee in the 1930s became places of horror and shame when the Germans came in and started hunting down Jews in these same hotels, and they became places of cowering and fear and terror. And one of the hotels became the center of the German efforts to round up the Jews. So I had to do a lot of reading on the World War II history in the south of France and Italy in order to tell this part of the story. And this process of going far afield from what might seem like the hardcore center, I enjoy very much.
Yes. You're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Robert Koenigel, author of High Season, How One French Riviera Town Has Seduced Travelers for 2,000 Years, published by Viking. How do you stop? When do you know it's time to stop doing research? Is it ever time, or does that happen after you hand the book in?
Yeah, no, it is hard. And there, at the beginning, I sometimes think of myself, at the very beginning of the research, I think of myself as kind of an all-embracing mother with my arms stretched wide to everything that could possibly come along. And then at the end of the research, I become sort of increasingly picky and choosy and stern. Will this really be appropriate to my book? Is this really going to find a place in my book? Do I really need to pursue this point? And then at the end, it has to overcome pretty considerable barriers for me to start researching it at that point. At that point, I see how the book is progressing. I see that I have the material that will allow me to develop the points that I want to develop, to tell the stories that I want to tell. And you just learn after a while, I guess, when to stop. But it's hard.
Will you read to us?
I can, sure. I could read you. This is, in some ways, this book is popular history. In some ways, it's journalistic. In some ways, it's impressionistic. I could read you from the very beginning of the book to sort of set the scene
okay.
for what comes later.
Sure.
It's from the prologue. I guess it's about three or four minutes. I don't know.
That sounds great.
Against the blackness of the sea at night, a bright blur of movement on the beach. It is near midnight, late June in Nice, on the French Riviera. Crowds of late-night tourists stroll along the Promenade des Anglais, the broad seaside boulevard crowned with palms that follows the great arc of the bay. A fresh breeze wafts in from the sea. Any breezier, any cooler, and it might feel chilly. But it's not chilly. It's perfect. The weather's always perfect here. You settle back into one of the blue wooden chairs that line the seafront. The ocean air washes over your bare arms and legs. Behind you, as you face the sea, a broad walkway divides the car traffic from the beach. Smartly dressed older couples shuffle amiably, arm in arm. Knots of teenagers. A young girl roller skating alone, blonde hair fanning out behind her. And spread out before you, the pebbly beach and softly murmuring sea. It's from here that you spy the ghostly movement revealed by lamps that flood the beach in light. Two young men reach down, tug off their shoes, and almost in tandem toss them aside. Then their shirts come off, and their pants, which land in a pile at their feet. They stop at their flimsy colored briefs and stand up straight. For a moment they hesitate, then run splashing into the water, limbs flailing, white streaks against the inky sea. The water's chill shocks them into silence. But soon the two of them, the surf lapping at their waists, are shouting themselves hoarse in German, frolicking in the water like happy children. Their yells grow rhythmic, and they start to sing, smoky Munich beer hall songs, one imagines, shunted to the coast of France. To the jaunty beat of their tune, they spank the sea in unison, slapping sheets of spray into the air. Then abruptly, back on the beach where they'd left their clothes, another blur of movement. It was easy to miss him as he stood motionless on the beach, fully dressed, but he'd been there all along. A third young man, friend of the other two. He'd climbed up to the promenade, carried a chair back down to the beach, and primly stood and watched as his friends cavorted in the surf. But now he can bear it no longer, and he, too, reaches down to pry off his shoes. Soon all three of them are yelling, splashing and singing, joyously, exuberantly happy.
Thank you.
Then it transitions into what high season is, a story of pleasure and escape.
Yes. Was the prologue there from the beginning, or did that come later after you wrote the book?
Well, there are many, the little section I just read you, I think I knew that had a special power, at least for me. Maybe I identified with the third person who finally yields and jumps into the water.
Yeah.
I think that scene had a special power to me at the time. But there's much else to the prologue. Then it leaves that specific scene and talks about the role of Nice and what I would be trying to do in this book. So no, I wouldn't say it came at the end. I'm trying to remember just how it came about, and I think I wrote it in approximately chronological order, but I don't remember.
Now, is this a book that you outlined? Is that how you work? Do you outline and know how things
no,
are going to fall?
No, usually I don't. And usually whatever I do, I'm wrong. I have very often, in this case, for example, I had a rough chapter sequence, a rough sense of how I wanted to proceed, but beyond that, I didn't. I don't like outlines. When I first began writing years and years ago, it's 30 years now, I would outline, and whenever I did, it was just deadly. And because outlines kind of reflect logical thought at work, you know, this leading to this and this leading to that, and that's very often not what you want. You want surprising juxtapositions. You want sort of unusual, unexpected things happening when, as I say, you're not expecting them. And to me, an outline gets in the way of doing that. So I had a rough chapter outline with some chapter titles and a general drift across the arc of the book, but not much more.
So you teach at MIT. Mm-hmm. How do you teach writing? I mean, I don't know. A lot of the students that I see in my classes come to the classes with rules that they've learned elsewhere that I kind of take and often kind of throw out the window and try to get them to make their own rules. For
right, I think you're doing
them.
The right thing. I really do. I think the rules. Most high school teachers. Think about it. Most high school teachers are not writers. They're teachers. Maybe they taught. Maybe they studied English in college, but they're not writers. That's not what they do. And I think it's natural to sort of hold on to some maybe simplistic formula about how one approaches things. And the one thing that I try to get across to my students is that there is no simplistic formula. I remember in one of my courses, this is back in Baltimore, I just moved to Massachusetts about about 3 years ago. It was about halfway through the course when somebody in the back of the room chimes in, "You mean you're not going to teach us rules for writing?" And it had just dawned on him at that moment. And I said, yes, there aren't rules. There are some principles. There's taste that can be developed. There can be a sense of form and shape and structure. There can be, and this is one of the most important parts, a kind of learning to let go, learning to go with intuitive processes rather than excessively rational or formulaic processes. I think some of that can be learned. A feeling for language, I'm not sure you can teach that. I think you learn that at your mother's and father's knee.
Interesting.
Early reading.
Mm-hmm.
Students do get better. That's one of the, I remember when I first started teaching writing, being surprised. I shouldn't have been surprised because that's what I was teaching. But I was surprised that the writing at the end of the course was better, markedly so, than the writing at the beginning of the course.
Yes.
This was gratifying.
It is gratifying.
Yeah.
Especially to see the students surprised. What about voice? How do you teach voice? How do you help your students find their voice? Because you most definitely have a voice that's extremely present in this book. How do you help others with voice?
Well, I think it's a letting go process that practically everybody needs to learn. Let me qualify that for a minute. There are few writers, I've encountered them, there are a few young writers who have to learn the opposite, namely that they have to bring their expressionistic rantings under some kind of clear rational control. They have to go from A to B to C. They have to organize more closely, etc., etc. This is the smallest minority of young writing students, I think. I think it's far more common is the tendency, well, I got to be thorough, I got to be careful, I got to cover this and I got to cover that, and if I don't, I'm bad, you know.
Yes.
And I think finding one's voice is finding the freedom to go with what seems important to you at the time. It might be later on when you get more serious about it, when you get more more adult and grown up about something that you've written, you may want to come back and say, well, I really do need to cover something like that. But if you let that get in the way at the beginning, where you're just covering yourself with shoulds and oughts, the person that's inside you will never come out.
Hmm.
And that's what I try to encourage them to do. I usually give them, for example, a writing assignment at the very beginning where I have taught them nothing, they have done nothing, they have read practically nothing, and all I want them to do is get something on paper, and with almost no other requirements than that. I call one assignment my flailing around assignment.
And then what happens? Do you have them do something at the end of the term and match it up?
You mean formally comparing,
yeah,
comparing the early stuff to the,
sure,
end? No. No. They, those who have made real progress will certainly discover that,
mm-hmm,
will have seen it themselves and are sometimes very grateful. Some people just remain sort of stuck in where they were, but most people make some progress.
Interesting. We're going to take a very short break. Stay with us for more Robert Kenigo, author of High Season, How One French Riviera Town Has Seduced Travelers for 2,000 Years. Be back in just a moment. Do not go away. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine, and on the internet at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we've been here with Robert Kenigo. And before we continue, I want to say that the opinions that you hear on this show are those of my guest and I, and not of the University of California Regents. And also, I want to tell you about a ticket giveaway. I have a bunch of tickets. tickets. I have tickets for Ted Nugent. I have tickets for Don McLean. I have tickets for the Doobie Brothers. I have tickets for Leon Russell, Edgar Winter, and Dave Mason. I think they're all at the Grove Theater. And if you, within the next week, week and a half, at night. So if you email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net, a pair of tickets may be yours. Welcome back, Robert.
Hi.
I was wondering about if, when you write, if you're thinking of the marketplace, because your books are not typically commercial, and yet they receive major acclaim. You have books that have been New York Times Notable Books of the Year. You've been a nominee for the National Book Critics Circle Award, finalist LA Times Book Award. You've been getting a lot of acclaim for your work. Do you give any thought to the marketplace as you're writing, or are you writing what you just pretty much need to be writing, and you worry about that later, or you don't worry about it at all?
No, I would say I worry about it at the beginning, and my agent helps me worry about it at the beginning.
In what way?
Well, she is reminding me that you may have some damn fool interest, Robert, but unless you can interest an editor, first an editor, then a group of editors representing the publishing house, you're not going to find a market to this and pay you any sort of reasonable advance. And so I'm interested in a lot of things, fortunately. And when I'm interested in something, first of all, I test myself to see whether I'm interested in something, not over a period of a week or a month, but over a period of a year or so. Most of the things that I'm interested in have been things that have, in some sense, stuck with me for often years. And then the test will come when I write a book proposal that is very definitely aimed at a commercial book publisher, where I'm trying to convince them that though on the surface my subject might seem to be of limited interest, you know, a turn of the century efficiency expert, a mathematician from India, a French town, that it can be dealt with in a way that's of vastly more appeal. And I suppose I say that I pride myself on taking obscure subjects and making them interesting to people. The way I sometimes envision it is that I'm throwing an arm around my reader and saying, hey, this isn't scary, this isn't difficult, this isn't formidable, this is just plain interesting. Let me show you. Let me tell you this story. This is great stuff. Trust me.
It's interesting. I can see you doing that, too. I can see you doing that. That's great. You said a few minutes ago when your agent and you talk about things, and she says that if you want to expect a reasonable advance, that you have to think about certain things. Now, what is considered a reasonable advance for narrative nonfiction, the type of narrative nonfiction that you write?
Well, I don't think I want to get into my personal finances. All I'll say is this, that first of all, it varies depending on your the stage of your career.
Mm-hmm.
So that when I wrote my first book, Apprentice to Genius, about, I guess it was 15 years ago, the $20,000 advance that I got then was fine, you know, what did I know? And it was enough to get me through writing the book. This is 1984, 85. And I wasn't, you know, quite as... I like good bicycles, by the way. And, you know, people have different interests.
Right, of course.
Okay? And so now I would, you know, I need more money. But that varies depending on the stage in your career you are, your other sources of income. But I don't want to make a...
Well, no, and I don't want you to. I guess why I'm asking is I had a discussion with my agent the other week about a proposal that that we've just handed in, and she's getting ready to send around, and she says, we get to the point of talking advance, and she says, well, if we're not offered a good advance, I mean, if somebody comes to us with only, say, $15,000, I don't think we should take something like that, because you'll get known as a writer who takes a little, who's happy with crumbs, and it'd be better to just market pieces of this proposal to magazines and make that $15,000 that way, rather than tying your life up for a couple of years on a measly advance. And I found that interesting, because I know other agents, of course, who will say, you know, $15,000 for a first book, great. So it seems to be rather relative.
It depends almost completely on, as I said before, the stage you are in your career, and how much you want to write this book.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just burning to tell a particular story, to do the research involved in a particular subject, and you can afford it, and you're not, you know, hungering for that last dollar right then and there, then who's to say that you shouldn't take on a project? On the other hand, I think I'm not dismissing the argument that your agent made. I think there may be truth to that you can develop that kind of a reputation. And certainly you don't want that. If you are, up until 3 years ago, I lived exclusively, almost exclusively, from my freelance writing. Now I'm a professor at MIT. I have that income. And it changes the sort of mental calculus that you go through in deciding whether to take on a project.
Mm-hmm. Are you still freelancing?
I can't say that I'm regularly freelancing now. I just did a foreword to somebody else's book, but I've been so caught up in dreary administrative stuff that I have not been freelancing. I did a book review last year, and I did this foreword, but I wouldn't say I'm in the freelance market right now.
Do you find it a relief, or do you find that the short form is pleasing and you miss it?
No. I started writing in 1970. I started my first book in 1984, and I've been doing almost exclusively books since then, with occasional shorter things thrown in. And when I wrote my first book, it was like night and day. It was like, I mean, it wasn't a big successful book. My second book provided a lot more of that kind of worldly kind of success that you create. But the first book was, it was so satisfying to do. It was so satisfying to spend so much time on something and really get, immerse yourself in a subject and finally see it between covers, that it sort of spoiled me that I didn't want to go back to shorter writing, where you sort of, you know, wham bam thank you ma'am,
yes.
Where it's something that you're working on for a week or two or 6 weeks and then you're finished with it. I like the long form.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and we have Robert Koenigl for a few more minutes. He's author of High Season, published by Viking. Anything else you can say regarding agents? I know your agent, and she's one of, you know, my most favorite agents. She just seems totally ethical and literate. There's a lot of very strange ones out there as well, and a lot of people listening to the show are in the process of looking for one. Can you offer any advice in that regard, or tips?
Well, I think, as so often is the case in life, there's at least two ways of looking at it. One is the sort of going about it very rationally. Who else does this person represent? Does this person represent the kind of books that I do, even remotely? How long has he or she been in the business? Where are they working out of? New York or elsewhere? What kind of recommendations can other writers that you know or have heard of make about that person? That's one side of it, and I think that's absolutely something that we should all do. But there's also the purely instinctive. You have to feel comfortable with your agent. This is somebody you're going to be working with closely. You have to, all these old-fashioned virtues like trust and character and all those sorts of things are important in the agent-writer relationship. And somebody coming along and saying, oh, I'll get you $1 million, and it's just sort of a slime ball, you're not going to feel comfortable working. Of course, maybe if they got you $1 million advance, you wouldn't worry about them being a slime ball. I think for most of us, I think those traits are very important, and it just sort of robs you of some of the whole good experience of being a writer if you're always worried about the character of the person you're working with as an agent.
Yes. We do have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, I seem to run into a lot of journalists, a lot of writers of narrative nonfiction who are hankering after finishing a novel, hankering after a book deal with a novel they're working on. Have you any interest in fiction?
None whatsoever. And it's interesting that you should bring this up, because the foreword I wrote that I was telling you about a minute or so ago is she was my editor at Johns Hopkins Magazine many years ago, and I worked with her for maybe a dozen years, and now she's written a book for Johns Hopkins University Press. It'll be coming out in the spring, I guess. I don't even know what she's going to call it, but it's sort of an idiosyncratic look at writing, and especially writing about science and medicine. And I know her very well, and I wrote the foreword. And one of the things that I said at one point was that Elise is the supreme nonfictionist. And I went on to explain what I meant. And I said exactly what you just said to me, that so many people are, oh, here I am, stuck being a journalist, and I don't want to do this, and this nonfiction. I really want to write the great American novel. And what I said in my foreword is that Elise was like that. She gloried in nonfiction, and I feel the same way, that the world is a pretty interesting place, and to have the opportunity to go out into the world and explore it and find out about it and tell your own version of the world that you see around you. It's a treasure. It's precious, and I expect to be happy doing this for the rest of my life, doing just that. And I have no interest in fiction.
Interesting.
I don't feel guilty about it. I'm happy.
I'm glad you're not guilty about it. I tell you, too many people, it's a little discouraging when you
hear. They feel that they should.
Yes.
And once again, it's a should that's doing damage. And I think some of those people who feel like they should and should be, you know, will be writing novels at some point. But I think some of them are probably, if they really explore themselves, they would find that they're very happy doing what they're doing. And they shouldn't listen to this extraneous should.
Yes. And any time a should comes up. Last words, pearls of wisdom, anything, any parting words you'd like to...
I'm not very good at that. Like I said, I like the long form, and that means being a little bit windy, and and you have to be able to write epigrammatically to be able to come out with pearls of wisdom. So you're stuck with the first 45 minutes of this program.
Well, you just said something pretty good. So anyway, I thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
That was Robert Canigal, author of High Season, published by Viking. And he spoke to us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. If you want to contact me, you can through my website, writersonwriting.com, or you can email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net. I told you about tickets earlier. I still have them, at least as far as I know. I'm not checking my email just yet. Leon Russell, Edgar Winner, Dave Mason on Sunday, September 1st at The Grove. The Doobie Brothers, next week sometime. at the Grove. Ted Nugent next week sometime at the Grove. And Don McLean there as well. So if any of those interest you, or if you just want to know specific dates, email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net. And if you haven't been a winner in the last 30 days and you are first, second, or third, you will get some tickets. The ASJA conference is UCI conference is coming along. You can find more information about that at ASJA.org. On the right side of the screen, you'll see Take Your Writing to the Next Level. And click on that, and you can read about all of the wonderful writers and literary agents and speakers that we have that will be at the conference on October 5th here at UCI. Joseph Wamba will be the keynote speaker at lunch. I will be interviewing him on stage at lunch. It'll be a great day, and there'll be a reception at the end of the day for the authors and for all of you. So go to ASJA.org, click on the right side of the screen, and you'll learn more. Okay, well, we're going to end a little early today. So first, I want to end with a quote by Natalie Goldberg, who said, "Writers live twice." How true. This is 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine, California. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Stay tuned for a little music. I may pull out a tape here, play part of an interview from some time ago. Have a great night, and talk with you again next week.